It's Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and my co-hosts are here. They are Philip Michaels and David J. Lohr. Hi, guys.
Who's the insurance salesman?
Ghost riders in the sky. A freelancer was looking for a steady paying gig. He went and got assignments that paid him to the jig. I don't know. I'm making this up.
It paid him quite a vig.
Vig. Oh, Jesus.
There
See, this
you
is
go.
Why this is why you have a writer's room, man.
That's right. That's
you kick around ideas.
You threw it in there. It's season 2, episode 12, Ghost Writer.
Not the PBS show.
No, and it's not the movie with Nicolas Cage. That's Ghost Rider. This is Ghost Writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are no ghosts in this episode because it is about no ghosts because it is about a woman who is a friend of Robin Masters and she is the best at ghostwriting autobiographies. However, she has a case for Thomas Magnum. But before that starts, we have to begin with the perplexing opening scene.
A very perplexing opening scene.
In which TC lands his helicopter on a roof, and while wearing gloves, he and another man remove boxes, metal boxes, full of danger. They're full of danger? There's a label on the side that says danger.
They're labeled danger.
And they're wearing very thick gloves to carry these boxes.
And
just gloves, though. No other protection. No goggles or smocks. Gloves.
They're not that dangerous.
So, mild danger.
And then TC is paid in cash, in a large wad of cash. They say, you never made this delivery.
This is my favorite part of the segment. Well, two parts of the segment I enjoy. When the guy says, remember, you never made this delivery. Yes, we have chosen the helicopter and the stealthiest form of transit in all of Hawaii to fly visibly through the air onto the top of this tall building.
Yep.
Which is Chekhov's tall building.
But you were never here. Oh, okay.
Nope, never.
I hope no one was looking up at the sky and saying, hey, look, the helicopter's landing up there. And the reason they might look up there is because the landing takes like 5 minutes of credit time. They do not spare once. We rented the helicopter for the day. We are using all of this goddamn footage of the helicopter landing on the building.
So let me ask you, fellows. What does the scene have to do with anything?
It has absolutely nothing. Those cases never show up again.
Nope.
I was trying to pay attention to that for the whole show, going, when does that come back?
There is not even an Easter egg later on when they are in the building and the cases are there going danger.
Yeah, we use these to keep this man alive or to kill him or something, but no, there's none of that.
No.
I have a theory.
Well, I got about 10 minutes into the show, and I'm like, I have no memory of ever seeing this one, which is crazy.
So I have a theory, which is that TC's story arc in this episode is supposed to be that because he's got this money, he doesn't do a favor for Magnum. And then he feels guilty, and he goes and saves Magnum, because that is what happens.
Yes.
Except that doesn't happen. That connection is not made. TC doesn't say, listen, because of like it, the TC getting the money does not lead to a moment where TC spurns Magnum and then feels guilty about it.
He spurns him because I can't take you to that building. I was delivering things there.
Right.
That'll ruin my money train or some such.
Oh, is
thing.
It?
I'm
is
not
it the,
allowed.
Is it the same building?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's
okay.
Because
all right. Well,
because
then that's
because it's the guy.
That's Emerson White, who's there with his magic special glove to keep from. That's the only connection.
All right. Hold on. Then you just blown my mind here. So wait a second.
Uh-huh.
So the boxes of danger are being delivered to the Farber building,
and
Farber's people have gotten them.
Yes,
but we never see what they are.
Correct.
We never see what they are.
I have
the only connection we have is
different
that we recognize
now.
That guy later.
It is never referred to
I have
again
different
at
questions.
Any point in the episode. When they see the helicopter come back, they don't go, "Oh, that's the guy who delivered all that danger stuff."
All
to
the
us.
Danger.
And again, I hope he's got more deliveries of the danger.
Well, then there should be a
ordered.
Payoff of the danger
we
somewhere in that building.
We weren't expecting the danger.
There should absolutely be okay. that. It's no, it's
terrible.
Because
you know, TC brings the danger.
Yeah. Anyway, TC, I love it because he got paid like several thousand dollars, and now he's talking about making investments and using phrases like "tut tut tut," and wearing a suit and sunglasses. I mean, I don't think it was that much money. It's like they paid him $1 million. They did not pay him $1 million.
There is one other part about this opening sequence that I want to call out because I had plenty of time to think about it while the helicopter was landing. And it's the list of guest stars. Not that they're, you know, all our old TV friends are coming back, though some are. It has, you get this all-time roster of names like Patch McKenzie. It's you know, the original party animal. Uh-huh. And Alan Fudge. Patch McKenzie and Alan Fudge are in this episode.
I know.
And I just sat and giggled.
And songmaster Ed Sheeran. Sheehan.
Each name is better than the last if you're a fan of goofy credits. So hats off to you, Patch McKenzie.
Yeah. Anyway, so that does. Well, you've just blown my mind now because it is the same tower, but the danger is never addressed.
No.
Like this should be like, well, the reason they need the to do the thing with the plot that we're about to talk about is because of the thing that's dangerous, or they needed to buy the thing that's dangerous, but it's never explained. Okay.
Not at all. Never mentioned again.
Well, thank you for clearing up the part that you did clear up and making the other part that much less clear.
I think what must have happened is they had this whole other plot that they just dropped.
Something. Well, as I said to Lauren afterward, Lauren and I watched last week's episode together, and then we followed with this week's episode, and then at some point, I think she fell asleep, and then she woke up and went to the store, and so when she came back, she said, "So what happened?" And I said,
"So this is our new segment. What is Lauren
what is
doing
Lauren
during the episode?
Doing during the episode? Sleeping, shopping.
Good. It's my favorite segment.
But she wants
to
know.
I gotta say." That was the right answer.
But she wants to know what happened, and that is now... So what this real segment is Jason tries to explain to his wife what happened in an episode of Magnum P.I.
Classic Lauren.
And what I say is, you know, a lot of nonsense happened, which was kind of fun, but the actual plot was never elaborated on. She's like, well, why do they, with the guy, and we can get to this when we get to the end, but like... The danger boxes suggest there is a whole other plot going on, which is there are these guys who have this company, and their Howard Hughes-like leader is dying or even dead, and they want to take control of the company for reasons. And there needs one more vote they need where they're his proxy in order to do something resembling anything. And the thing about the episode, as I told Lauren, is none of that is ever explained. It really is more like TC lands a chopper on the roof, there's some gunfire and some punching, and then it's all fine. Like that is how it gets resolved when there's this whole other part. And my question for you two gentlemen is, what do we want to get out of Magnum? Do we want the camaraderie and the nonsense and then the punching and the thing is over? Or do we want a plot about how the guys at the top of a weirdos corporation are buying dangerous boxes of stuff for some reason? I think if you're going to give me a box of danger, I want to know what's in it. I mean, this is not exactly Pulp Fiction, but it is weird. Like, why go to this elaborate step for something that could be much, much more simplified?
This is the segment where you and I explain to Jason what we want out of Magnum P.I.
I'm not watching Magnum P.I. necessarily for the intricate plotting.
That's good.
However,
I'm worried about our friend Phil. He's looking for intricate plotting.
Yeah, why is he watching Magnum P.I.?
This is not
The Wire. What the hell is going on here? While I don't need intricate plotting, I do at some level need the basic tenets of storytelling to tick a few boxes. And this clearly there was a plot like you say, where there was a thing going on and they're voting on a thing and they need the danger boxes to do the thing. And someone said, whoa,
yeah.
This is Magnum P.I. We just want punching and hygiene.
Or they ran long, in the script process or in the shooting process. They're like, what are we going to cut? Are we going to cut the punchy and the hijinks? No. Or are we going to cut
helicopter
the explanation
landing
about these two guys who we're never going to see again and their plot for some corporation we made up? And they're like, cut that part. They're like, all right.
And the funny thing about the episode possibly running long, which is not a bad theory, there are parts of this episode
helicopter
which are
cut.
There are inert. Patch McKenzie, the original party animal.
Right.
She delivers lines where she just sort of stops and looks at Magnum.
So okay, that leads me to believe that this was a script level thing where at some point in the script they told Caroline Elias, the credited writer on this, they told her or one of the producers rewrote it and took out the corporate intrigue part of the plot and made it more of nonsense. Except they're like, but keep in the danger boxes because that's cool.
Because danger box is cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is possibly not a phrase that was ever used in 8 seasons in the writer's room, but I do kind of appreciate Aristotelian unity in a plot. I'm just saying.
No, I believe episode 8, season 8, episode 3 was called Aristotelian
Unity. Well, that's true. That's the one where they blow up
Aristotelian
unity. But this plot, like the danger part of the plot, the danger box part of the plot, the Howard Hughes part of the plot, it really feels like a late era classic Hawaii 5-0. And then it's just in a Magnum episode.
Well,
it's weird.
Okay, so now I'll throw in some other. I haven't really stepped us through the plot, but I mean, look,
why should you be bothered if
it's
they
a sequence of a,
we've
of
already
unrelated
given up
events
on that?
No, I want to mention though that there is the plot here is basically that the Howard Hughes like guy Harold Farber has agreed to be have the ghostwriter, who is played by Patch McKenzie, the original party animal. Virginia Fowler is the name of the character. She is going to ghostwrite his autobiography. So she's got a lot of documents and she's got recordings of her phone interviews with him, but he's a recluse and she's never met him. She's in Hawaii and she's hoping to meet him for the first time. And her hotel room gets turned over and her notes and recordings are basically stolen. So she's like, somebody I wrote about in this book stole all this stuff and doesn't want this book to happen, and Magnum, you need to help figure out who that is. So that is the plot. What we find out in this episode, I'm gonna break it down this way this time because it's nonsense, is Harold Farber is this recluse. He has his own little building. They go there, he and the ghostwriter, Magnum and the ghostwriter, go there and meet his butler,
who is older than dirt.
Barker, who is
that guy?
That guy,
John
Lormer,
who's in all kinds of stuff. He's in 3 episodes of the classic Star Trek.
Yeah, he's a character from a comedy sketch. He is a comically, he's like, and I want to say Saturday Night Live, but that's not right. He's from a Monty Python sketch. He is a comically almost dead elderly man whose job is to...
I'm going to correct you there. Okay. He is not from Monty Python or Saturday Night Live. He is like from Fridays or one of the
Mad
comedy
shows.
I would say, the reason I said Monty Python is he is, as a concept, a bizarre character.
It's
the execution
is poor.
He is,
oh,
so
you know
he's
what
a
it
butler.
Is.
He's decrepit. He's fallen all over himself. It's
Tim Conway's old man from the Carol Burnett Show.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's what it is.
So it's a sketch comedy character. And like there are so many bits of business that he does, which leads to the plot point where how they break in, which is that Virginia, our ghostwriter, trips him, declares that he's had a heart attack, and begins aggressively giving him assault CPR as he scrambles and is like, no, oh,
he's
God.
Like,
and
I'm sitting there thinking,
she's going to kill him. She's going to kill
stop
him.
Stop breaking my ribs.
And that's after they have Larry Minetti deliver bottle cases of wine to him and stacking it in such a way as to break this old man's spine in his.
Well, yeah, so he can copy his key.
This is right on top of another like great 60s sitcom trope, right? Where Rick is like, you want me to do a favor? Well, I'm not going to dress up as an electrician or a plumber or any one of these things. I don't want to dress up as anything. And as he's doing it, now, like I said, I have no memory of this episode. But as he's doing it, I'm thinking of F Troop, and it's like, I'm not going to put on that dress, Sergeant O'Rourke. You're going to put on that dress, Agon. I'm not going to put on that dress. Hi, I'm wearing a dress.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, he's a delivery guy.
There's a lot of comic bits. In fact, I think I'm going to propose one theory, which is that Caroline Elias wrote this as a straightforward episode, and they ripped out all of the corporate espionage and put in more bits. There are some good comedy bits, but I would say that I actually kind of like this episode, even though it's complete nonsense, because it's so goofy. Among the bits that I like, and you guys should throw in your own bits.
Okay.
Among the bits I like, Magnum gets dressed up to pretend to be her assistant to go to the tower. He puts on a suit. The dogs don't react to him. And Higgins says the line, a legitimate laugh out line, oh, they don't recognize you all dressed up. And then he speaks and they start barking at him. And then he narrates himself about how he's late to his meeting with her, and he blames himself. He took too much time on picking out the tie, and she says, I like the tie, and he looks at the camera, and I think I'd like to nominate this as maybe the best Magnum camera take, or at least up there, because
top five.
Because the idea is he's narrating to us, so he's already talking to us. And then she and he says, I'm worried about the tie, and she says, nice tie, and he looks at the camera like, see?
Not just that, Jason. He does that. She says, nice tie. And there was a long enough beat to where I actually said out loud, look at the camera, Magnum. And he looks at the camera, and I high five no one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's really good. Really good bit. Really good bit.
That was the one time they made really good use of the lags in time in this episode.
Yeah. So the gentleman's gentleman Barker, the comedy sketch butler, comes and takes them, and they're gonna meet the guy, and then you cut to a dining room, and they walk in wearing surgical scrubs.
Well, and it's like a clean room.
Yeah.
Right? There's no decoration.
It's like Dexter's room where he.
Yeah.
Kills his victims. It's very, you're like, oh, they are just totally doing the Howard Hughes thing here. By the way, in this building, all their surveillance is done on very fine film cameras that have been.
Oh, that is some beautiful stuff.
Not video cameras at all. They're very fine film cameras. Anyway, Elisha Cook appears.
No.
He is.
Ice Pick.
He is not Ice Pick in this episode. Wouldn't that be a twist?
Because this is season two, this predates his Ice Pick appearances.
In fact, they liked him so much, they brought him back and made him Ice Pick. And he, or perhaps Elisha Cook liked his Hawaiian vacation so much that they brought him back.
Hey, guys, speaking of Elisha Cook Jr., the producers of Elisha Cook, the thief, his wife and her lover and
See Us for Cookie
would like to introduce a new segment.
Oh, God.
Now You're Cooking with Elisha. So in this episode, Jason, I'm sure you were about to mention that a lot is made of the wine. They have a fancy French red wine that Elisha Cook does not agree with.
They serve Chateau Lafite 1948 or something, and he says, we're out of Muscatel.
He wants Muscatel. Whoa, hey. So that got me thinking, Elisha Cook is quite the wine connoisseur. I want to see if you guys are wine connoisseurs. So I'm going to ask you some true-false questions about wines and see if you know as much as Elisha Cook. Jason, would you like to go first? Let's have you go first.
I would but I will. It's fine.
I would like you to go first.
Okay.
Wine should be more acidic than the food that you're serving it with.
I'm going to say true.
That is correct. Very good, Jason. Very knowledgeable. Yeah. David?
Mm-hmm.
Red wines pair best with bold flavored meats.
That is true.
That is very true. So we can assume in this episode that if the dinner proceeded, they were going to have a bold flavored meat to go with that Chateau Lafite. Jason?
Yes.
It's your turn.
Okay.
Well, that's how you know, because it rhymes. Bold flavored meat with Chateau Lafite.
You should never serve bitter wine with fatty foods.
I'm going to say that's true.
No, that is false. Bitter wines are best balanced with a little bit of fat.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would probably not want a bitter wine, but...
Mm. Well, then you don't know much about wine, clearly.
I don't.
You ignorant fool.
Why am I on this show?
Or
why
just avoid fatty foods.
David?
Yes?
It's better to match wine with the sauce than the meat.
That would be false.
Oh, I'm sorry. That is true, David. No, you want to pay attention to that sauce when you're trying to pick out
the wine. Damn you, Elisha Cook Jr.
Mm. All right, and this is, since we're tied at one apiece... I'm gonna make this, and whoever this wants to buzz in first, grab your buzzers, gentlemen. Wine should not be sweeter than the food. Who wants to buzz in on that?
Buzz?
It's okay, that's
is,
Jason.
Mine
that
is
was
jammed.
A,
damn
there
it.
There was a ghostwriter-like pause.
Wine,
in between
said, so what was the question? Wine should not be sweeter than the food?
That is correct, Jason. Is that true or false?
I would say that's true.
No, that's false. Wine should be sweeter than the food. I'm going to give this award to Elisha Cook Jr.
Yes,
for teaching us so much about wine. And that concludes Now You're Cooking with Elisha from the producers of C is for Cookie and Elisha Cook, the thief.
His wife and her lover.
Yeah. What
mysteries
will...
And now I'm looking at the camera.
Yeah.
After he says we're out of Muscatel, by the way... He falls off the chair.
Passes
and they
out.
Say, we got to get him to the hospital. And they're like, no, he's a rich man. The hospital comes to him. We'll take him to Dr. Roberts. Being my friend, you say you call Dr. Roberts. Dr. Roberts, he's a new... I went somewhere else there.
It's because Revolver just came out. I get it.
They know who
Tony
Magnum
Sindelar.
Is. And they are suspicious... So Magnum does the right thing to take her back to the estate, which leads to the line, I was in naval intelligence, and she says, you don't seem like the type. I mean, the Navy part.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a break-in at the estate. Somebody with gloves on sprays the lads, and they collapse, which is horrible. Like, oh, no.
Yeah, no, PETA really wants to have a word with the producers of Magnum P.I.
And then a hilariously weird set of circumstances happen where simultaneously a man in black breaks into the guest house where Magnum and the ghostwriter are, and a sniper begins shooting at Magnum.
Yes.
All at once.
Presumably not Normie from the previous episode that we talked about on Magnum PI, because that will air in like three more seasons.
Presumably not. So I think this is like being a private investigator on hard mode, which is like, what if somebody's shooting at you and there's a prowler at the same time? What do you do?
It helps that the prowler is both inept and easily cowed.
Yes.
I think
Magnum basically pushes him down and says, you stay there. And that's it. And he stays there.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point he looks around like maybe he could get away, but he does not make any attempt to get away. It's Oscar. Oscar broke in. It turns out Oscar works for Mrs. Ballard. At one point he says, who is this guy? And she says, oh, that's just Oscar. Okay. Mrs. Ballard.
That's so Oscar.
Mrs. Ballard is the wife of Senator Ballard. And she had an indiscretion, which she then explains was after she became a widow and before she married Mr. Ballard, Senator Ballard.
Mr. Future Senator Ballard.
She had an indiscretion with Harold Farber. Now, I would say in modern terms and mores, she did not have an indiscretion because she was not married to anyone at the time. But be that as it may, she doesn't want that information to come out, and so she didn't want it in the book. However, she wasn't involved in the shooting, so it's like, well, what is really going on here? She, I think it's strongly implied now, she is actually the one who was behind the theft in the Ghostwriter's hotel room.
But that's what one gathers, yes.
As again, far as not one explained can tell, at all.
Not explained at all.
Not adequately ticked off.
No.
Anyway, Magnum says that she's writing a biography, but he can't say who it's about. Rick wants to know. Magnum says it's him. Everybody has a good laugh at that. So yes, he as Phil mentioned earlier, Rick basically bugs the poor comedy old man and copies his key so that they can, as part of this plot, go up in the secret private elevator while the ghostwriter is doing aggressive assault CPR on the poor old comedy old man.
I would also like to point out that Mrs. Ballard, the old woman, earlier when we see Elisha Cook, he was a wrinkly old man, but not that wrinkly. He was wearing lots of old age makeup. For a moment, when they introduced Mrs. Ballard, I thought, oh, Elisha Cook Jr. is in a dual role where he is playing an old woman as well. And no, it's just a very tiny Elisha Cook-sized old woman.
This leads to the climax where TC is not going to go on the roof for reasons that you guys explained to me, which is that there's danger boxes there, and they might pay him a lot of money later, and they're not going to do that. So what they do is a plan where Magnum, where the ghostwriter, Virginia, is going to go up there and assault the guy, and then Magnum is going to bring the senator's wife, who has been in the trunk of his car. They're going to go into the elevator, and they're going to go to the penthouse, because Magnum suspects that this is not actually the guy. Which leads
to try and get her letters back so that nobody can find out about her indiscretion.
So he would have the letters. That's right. So she doesn't
and
suspect
so it's
that
to help
point.
Her get up there. All right. That's all. Magnum doesn't suspect anything
all right.
yet.
Okay. Well, so it leads to a Scooby Doo-esque series of slinkings in the hall with Magnum
and going in and out of doors.
Magnum, the ghostwriter. Lover.
Ghosts, see? Ghosts!
No, but there are no
ghost
rider.
Magnum, we have to find power!
And then they get caught and they get put in a holding cell with Elisha Cook.
Who we now know is not Mr. Ballard. Well, no, we don't know that
he
yet.
He doesn't look the same. And then she looks at the scar on his chest and he doesn't
have
it.
That's where she finds out.
And so she knows that this is not Harold.
This isn't Harold Farmer.
Not Harold. That they do escape. They escape by what I think was actually an amusing way to escape, which is Magnum notes that they're watching them on a rotating camera. That we've seen all the cameras in this place. So Magnum gathers up all of his pals and they stay behind the camera as it rotates. And the guy's like, where are they? I don't see them. I guess I better go in there. And then when he goes in there, Magnum and Virginia the ghostwriter are kissing each other on the far side. And he says, hey, we don't allow any of that here. Strange rules.
There's no kissing in the holding cell. No, Jason, I don't mean to dispute your description of this scene as comical. The scene in Goldfinger where Sean Connery is popping up in front of the window to distract one of Goldfinger's men and then disappears, and Goldfinger's man goes, oh, I better go in the cell, and then Sean Connery cold cocks him. That's a good, well-done scene because it's done quickly. Whereas this
is
helicopter landing on the building.
Magnum's battle of wits with the camera goes on for a very, very, very,
back,
very
back,
long time.
Forward, back, back.
And he has to explain it, not just to Ghostwriter, but also to the old woman.
Yes.
None of them are able to grok. What are you doing, Magnum? No, look at the camera.
Also,
it's moving.
When the camera is looking at Magnum trying to pull the door and falling down, it's at a low angle where there is no camera. Yeah. All the other shots are high up, and they're all kind of like not what the little mounted camera would look like. They're all
they're very
around.
Shaky and jittery.
Yes, because they're being held by a TV cameraman.
Yeah,
it's very strange. Anyway, he does go there. They're kissing, and the senator's wife hits him over the head with what looks like a tray from a buffet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she is very proud of delivering that killing blow.
Knocks him cold. And that leads to the truce. True Scooby-Doo moment. Because again, we have Magnum, the ghost writer, the senator's wife, and the fake rich guy drunk. And they are all in the hallway. And her lover.
And all of a sudden you hear Pretty Mary Sunshine coming right for me. Singing on the soundtrack. It's totally scary.
Wacky. But it gets wackier, people, because they're out in the hallway and they hear the guys are coming. And as Magnum is there with his gun, or the guy's gun that he's taken from the guy who got hit by the buffet, by the chafing dish or whatever, there's a door with a big sign on it that doesn't say danger, but it does say, like, what, corrosive?
It says, do not enter?
Corrosive.
Yeah.
And they all go in there. And Magnum looks back and he's like, oh, I guess we'll go in there. It is an interesting room. For a few reasons. It's an interesting room because there is a tube in it where there is a frozen dead body of the actual guy, they're like, oh, he's very dead. And I'm like, he could be, it's cryogenics, man. But yeah, he's totally dead.
But yeah. But that's why there's a ghost. She's literally writing for a ghost.
He's not a ghost, though. He's just a dead guy.
Well.
That says you.
And she had been interviewing him, which is, speaking of things in this plot that are not resolved, one of the things that I wanted to hear was how long has he been dead? Because the ghostwriter been talking to the incoherent fake guy, or was she talking to the real guy? Because if she was talking to the real guy, she might still have a book. If the senator's wife will give her back her stuff, maybe she would still have a book about this interesting guy for history. But it could also be a fake, but they don't say.
Again, it's heavily implied that she's been talking to the fake guy because the reason they set that up was to prove that he was quote-unquote still alive.
Yeah,
so that
but
this
how,
guy could be the proxy vote.
But for how long?
Because
they also specifically ask her, when was the last time you talked to him? And she says, well, last week, but he was completely incoherent and made no sense. And they're like, but he was alive. And so I'm unclear whether that was the proof that they needed.
There you go.
Or whether they needed so did he come in at some point, or does she actually have the work of the book? The episode, friends, is not interested in this.
No.
He's not interested in these questions at all. In fact,
Aristotle was rolling in his grave.
Now, while we talk about things this episode doesn't care about, the episode also doesn't seem to care that the danger corrosive room is actually a hallway that just leads to the staircase.
Well, sure, because if the guy rises from the dead, he needs an exit. That's simple OSHA requirement.
Like, is this danger room?
That's how ghosts work.
They're going to be trapped in the danger room, except they just go out the back to the staircase.
Because when Christ rose from the dead, he needed an angel to help roll the stone away. And OSHA said, hey, whoa, time out here. There needs to be another exit in all tombs.
In this building, you have Alan Fudge to roll away the door.
You exit through the frozen dead body of your founder. And they do, and they go up to the roof where TC... Okay, the other part of this plot that's hilarious is Magnum is gone for an indeterminate amount of time. They're in that room a long time, so it's like hours, and it was maybe overnight, even a day.
Overnight, because there's specifically a line where Higgins has told TC, oh no, Magnum never came home.
He never came back, and TC's racked with guilt, so he says, I am going to go up there, and then he's hovering like, we've been here a long time.
We're going to hover and wait outside the top of the building because that's clearly where Magnum is going to go.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that Magnum said that's where he wanted him to go.
And the gas tanks on helicopters are massive, as you well know.
And Magnum, who's in this life or death situation, says, I think TC probably came around and is waiting for me. Which is like,
yes.
Okay, sure. So they go up there and TC's totally there and he comes down and he's trying to get them all out, but the guys come up because they found them and they have gunfire. And then they take off, and TC takes off with the senator's wife and the ghostwriter, leaving Rick and Magnum and drunk Elisha Cook on the roof. There's an exchange of gunfire, but as in most 80s shows, nobody is hit by any bullets, and then they're out of bullets. And so
then
there's a fight. an unorthodox fight for two reasons. One, Magnum is worried about Elisha Cook falling to his death, so he decides to give him a couple of spins to make him dizzy so maybe he won't fall to his death, which doesn't really work. And yeah. Rick, meanwhile, does an unorthodox move. He has to take on two guys, so what does he do? He leaps at them sideways to knock them over, which he does. And then Magnum comes over and helps clean things up.
Several things about this fight. First, I thought when he was spinning Elisha Cook around, I thought he was going to slingshot him into the guys, because right? That seems like Magnum's level of thinking. Also, in this high security, heavily armed place, there are apparently two guns.
Yes.
One of the ones that
and
Magnum
only
took,
two guys.
Those two guys. Those two guys.
There are two guns and six bullets between them. So Magnum has taken the gun off the guy. So the other guy is the only guy with the gun. And yep. It's not, let's go back to the armory and get more guns and bullets.
Well, they would have escaped by then.
They spent all their money on the
helicopter. Flown away. The helicopter is not coming back.
Yeah, that's true.
They spent all their money on the danger boxes and TC.
Yeah.
They were out of money.
They should have
the danger boxes. They should
have thrown them at Magnum. Ah, you've got no gloves. Catch this without gloves. I'd like to see you try.
Elisha Cook wanders over to the edge of the roof, but they pull him back, and it's fine. Oh. Cut to the estate. Our ghostwriter friend decides she's going to write a new book. This one will be about Magnum. The end.
Yeah.
Question mark.
No. It's the end.
What about the senator's wife? What about the company? What about those guys?
I think you can answer those in one word, Jason, and that word is meh.
Yeah. Then Lauren comes home, and I'm like, there was a lot of nonsense, and TC picks them up off the roof, and then there's a gunfight, and then Rick jumps sideways and knocks a couple of guys over, and that's it. Like, there's no. That's it. The guy was dead. Elisha Cook Jr. is a fake. And yeah. Why were they doing it? I don't know.
And I mean, I kind of imagine her looking at you very patiently, and you finish this, and she just goes, okay.
Oh, yeah.
And goes on about her
life. She knows the drill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was nonsense.
There are two notes of this episode that I would like to point out.
Okay.
First off, the hotel, the estate where Ghostwriter is staying before she goes and takes refuge at Magnum's, is in fact the place where the weird sex party was held and all roads lead to Floyd.
Yeah.
That's right.
I noticed while watching that, I said, this is familiar to me. Yeah. And then I confirmed it in Magnum-Mania, the Bible of the Magnum podcast.
Yes.
Secondly, Patch McKenzie, the original party animal, appeared in ER, the original ER, with Elliot Gould and George Clooney. No, not that ER. In this one, he's an ambulance driver. Mm-hmm. Or
named Ace.
Named Ace. And yeah,
I watched that.
I did too. I really liked that show.
It was a good show.
That was a really good show.
It was based on a stage play from Chicago, and mm-hmm. Norman Lear's company bought it and turned it into a spinoff of The Jeffersons.
Wow, I didn't know The Jeffersons connection.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Mm. Well, anyhow, good on you, Patch McKenzie, for supplementing that Bud Light.
Escaping the pyramid scheme sex party.
Yeah. Huh?
And Patch McKenzie also appeared, because I also looked her up going, why? Why I know that name? Why do I know that name? This is not why. It did turn out to be
it
ER.
Might be why?
But she also appeared on the amazing live Sea Monkeys, an 11-episode series with Howie Mandel.
Well, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
good for Patch McKenzie.
Yeah.
That brings us to a new segment for this episode. If you've only heard this one, otherwise it's a really standard. Segment. It's the letter segment. You can send us an email at magnum@theincomparable.com and we might read your email.
People are still doing that, huh?
We get letters. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Team Magnum Podcast.
No? Hi, letter writer.
Wanted to get your take on a Magnum head scratcher that has bothered me for a while.
Oh man, I used to have a Magnum head scratcher. It was by Hasbro.
The King Kamehameha Club is purported to be one of the most upscale and refined places in all of Honolulu. Yet,
I think we've discussed this on many a podcast.
It is consistently festooned with cheap plastic furniture, tacky disposable party store supply decorations, and AstroTurf. What gives?
Boy, is it.
This is more implausible than Magnum being able to tail someone in a red Ferrari. Thanks for the great podcast, Jeff.
So that it was from Pat Hingle wrote that letter.
I have a very simple explanation for that.
I think my explanation is probably going to match yours, so go ahead.
It probably is. Once you hit the third season, they can't afford to go to the real club anymore.
Nope.
So it's a stage set.
Yeah, that's it. It's they're cheap. And they didn't think anyone would much care. But yeah, I think this is one of the one of those instances where if you're going to use the King of Kamehameha Club, and they clearly do a lot, pay up for something that looks like a nice club.
Yeah, because they get the scenes where they're like outside on the beach, and you're like, oh yeah, this is good stuff. And then they get those scenes where they're just in a box with no windows.
Yes,
and like in a basement somewhere. And like, why would anyone pay to be in this club?
Well, like as you know, Hawaii is famous for its terrible views.
It's foul and noxious air.
If you watch this episode, you know, it's now this is clearly shot at an actual place.
Yes.
But it does have that white lattice work in the background in some of it. It's got green all over. It's like they took this and said, hey, let's copy it really, really cheaply for those indoor scenes. It's weird. And like Allred's lead to Floyd, Rick has a great office. And suddenly, it's like they used all his windows in the first season, and now he doesn't have an office with windows.
The windows budget is blown.
Yeah. Because windows meant having to show Hawaii.
Exactly. Because that's why you're there, is to show Hawaii.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Yes.
I don't think we have an in-universe. The in-universe reason is that Rick is a terrible manager and he's lost so much money for the club that they are barely keeping their head above water.
Uh-huh.
That's the in-universe explanation.
They only let Magnum into the cheap side of the club.
That could be.
That's, you know, it's plausible.
And that leads me to our final segment of this episode, which is what episode are we covering next time? And we're going to follow from the last episode, listener Chris's recommendation, and do the Black on White with Ian McShane as a guest star, season 3, episode 6. And that means Chris now is in peril of receiving the Listener Blair Award.
Oh, the suspense.
So we'll see.
Will it be a dream or a dud? Oh.
The Joel Hodgson bit? Is that what that is? Yeah.
Well, it was an actual commercial, Jason.
It was for Mystery Date.
Before it was a Joel Hodgson bit?
Yeah, he took the actual commercial for the board game Mystery Date.
I never saw that.
And turned it into a bit. Oh, no, well, go on YouTube, friend.
Oh, yes.
Go on YouTube and search for Mystery Date, and you will...
Will he be a dream? Will he be a dud?
I won't. And that ends this episode of the Magnum Podcast. We'll be back next time again with Black on White, Season 3, Episode 6. We're winding up our third, I guess, season of Magnum Podcast. We'll have a couple episodes and then a Christmas special, and then we'll take a break. But we've got a little more for you, so come back then. And until then, I'm Jason Snell, and they have been David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. Bye, guys.
Zoinks, Thomas. I'm not going to dress up as a delivery guy.
Muscatel for all, my friends!